True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Ellen Bohm's husband left her for another woman, abandoning his three children without visitation or financial support. With only her secretarial job to support them, Ellen had to move her children out of the family home and into an apartment building. Money was tight, but Ellen had some strange priorities that made it even tighter. She was crazy about professional wrestling, and she traveled to attend matches whenever she could, wherever she could, leaving her kids with her mother. In many ways, Ellen lived in her own fantasy world. She wrote letters to her favorite wrestling personalities and bragged to her friends about her popularity with these men. No one actually believed that Ellen had any romantic involvement with them, but it seemed harmless enough, until her children began to die. Join us at the quiet end for Mommy's Little Moneymakers. There were some crucial emotions missing in Ellen Bohm, including kindness, honesty, and maternal love. She began to see killing her own children as a means to an end, solving her financial problems. When suspicions turned to certainty, friends and co-workers were appalled, but Ellen showed no sadness or remorse for any of the atrocities that she committed. So this case, I'm really going to ask a lot of you, Dick, to give us some background on a lot of medical things. So that should be fun.
Well, I'll do my best.
So what have you brought us for a beer?
So the beer today is Sump Coffee Stout, brewed by Perennial Artisan Ales in St. Louis. This is an imperial stout. It's 10.5% alcohol by volume. And it is very coffee forward. This beer is a very black beer, tiny little head. It has a coffee aroma and what I consider just a roasted malt aroma. And as I said, this coffee taste lasts throughout the sip. A little chocolate in there, too. This is a big-bodied beer meant to be sipped and savored. Take it easy.
Oh, believe me, I will. It's going to last me all day. So let's open it up. All right, bring those snifters down here with me. Come on up to the mic and let's have a talk.
Okay, I'll get started. Let's do some background on Ellen and her family of origin. Her father, John Booker, left his first wife, Mary Booker, along with their five sons and two daughters.
High and dry.
That was it. Now, his kids knew that he was a drinker, and he always had a woman or two on the side. But they also believed that their father really loved his wife, Mary, and would never leave her. Well, shows how much kids know about that stuff, huh?
It really does, yes.
The divorce was pretty hellish for Mary. She still loved her husband. Though she was only 41 years old when he left her, she never remarried, and she never even dated anyone again.
Well, I imagine that's hard to do with seven children to support on your own.
To date?
Yeah, it'd be hard to date. How many men are going to really want to get in on
that? That'd be the other issue.
That's a huge expense.
You know, even if you've got this wonderful woman, she's got seven kids. It's a little difficult.
It's a challenge.
John, he remarried almost immediately. He moved to St. Louis, and within a year, his new bride, whose name was Catherine, was pregnant. Catherine miscarried this pregnancy, but then quickly became pregnant again. And when the little girl was born, Catherine named her Ellen. Ellen turned out to be Catherine's only child. John's second youngest child, living with Mary, his former wife, was a little toddler named Rita. Rita didn't meet old John, old Dad, until she was 4 years old. And all she can remember is a man coming into the house, picking her up and swinging her around. He kissed her, put her back down, and left the room. That was that. Now, maybe some of his issues came from his own childhood tragedy, which is significant. When he was 13, he lost his father in a fatal car and train accident. He was left with a final memory of his father on fire, burning to death in the wreckage. John was in the accident, and so was his father's sister. She also died, and there was another couple and their baby. They all died. John was the only survivor.
Yes, so that had to be pretty tough.
I can imagine. It'd be very tough.
And that's really when he started having a difficult time, quit high school, went to work, and he did work hard. As a working man, though, he became a drinker with a really short temper. He was frequently involved in bar fights. So he lived with his mother on a successful farm, so he was really financially well off. In addition to the family home, which was set on cotton fields, there were other pieces of land, some that had other houses of their own on them. So one by one, John sold off these houses, and he wasted the proceeds on women and drink. Finally, his mother changed her will, so the last 82 acres with the main house was protected from him, and that land would never be able to be sold until after John himself died.
Good protection.
Yeah, he was quite an alcoholic at that point. So John returned to Mississippi for his ex-wife Mary's funeral in 1977, after Mary suddenly died of a heart attack when she was 61. He was very emotional there, and his children would never forget how he cried and cried at her funeral. Ellen and her mother, Catherine, understood that he needed to go to the funeral because this, after all, was the mother of his 7 older children. But then he ended up abandoning Catherine and Ellen a few months after that. Ellen was a high school junior when that happened. Her father was 64 years old and in poor health. He would never come back to live with Catherine and Ellen. Within a year, he returned to St. Louis, and he was put into a nursing home. So that's pretty sad.
It certainly is.
Yeah. Within months, in June of 1979, though, he did die of cancer. Ellen did inherit her 1/8 share of that farm, which one of her stepbrothers ended up buying from her. But most of what her father had left her was just pain and brutal insecurity. Even before he had left Ellen and her mother, he'd been cold, he'd been strict, and of course emotionally unavailable. He was drunk most of the time and often emotionally and physically abusive. So like many children of alcoholics, what Ellen did was she married the first man who paid any attention to her. And this guy would turn out to be a lot like her father, and I mean a lot.
Yes, yeah, so when she first met him, his name was Paul Bohm. He was a married man living alone in a small apartment because his marriage was falling apart and he wasn't making any efforts to fix it. Paul had met his first wife when he was in Vietnam, and she was a young woman in St. Louis writing letters to soldiers. This was part of a pen pal service. Paul had given up writing home to his family in California because they never wrote him back. One day a fellow soldier showed him a handful of letters from young women back in the States, and he urged Paul to give it a try. And in St. Louis, Susan Emily, who was a young mother with 2 children and 3 jobs, drew Paul's name out of a hat. Susan was working at a local bowling alley at that time, and her co-workers had to convince her to pick a name out of the hat. So she did, and this simple act of picking a name out of the hat changed her life, and probably not for the better.
No, probably not. In the spring of 1970, when Paul came home for a 30-day leave, that's when they met and they were engaged, pretty quickly. Within a year, they were married, and months later, Paul legally adopted Susan's 2 daughters. Susan was happy to get Paul, who didn't seem to mind that she was quite overweight. During their marriage, whenever she mentioned her weight problem, he just always assured her. He said, "Oh, I just love all 300-plus pounds of you, baby." So after his tour of duty in Vietnam ended, Paul and Susan moved to Heidelberg, Germany, where he was stationed until 1973. And Susan thought this was just very exciting, this life. She liked it. While in Germany, Susan and Paul had a son, Paul Duane Jr., and then from Germany, the family moved to Colorado, and then to Fort Lewis, Washington, where they had another daughter named Terry Lynn. And after Paul was discharged, the family returned to St. Louis, and Paul took a job driving for bi-state buses. But by the spring of 1978, the marriage was over. Paul was ready to move on. He'd met a fun young girl on his bus route, and she was young enough to be his daughter, and this was Ellen Booker. She was actually quite a bit like Susan, cute, agreeable, and at least 100 pounds overweight. So he had a type.
We know his type.
So as Paul began planning his marriage to Ellen, he rented out the upper floor of a house down on Wyoming Street in St. Louis. Ellen was excited about living together, and she's the one that found the place. At this time, the rent was only $100 a month, which for Paul was a real bargain because he'd been paying $150 a month for his smaller place. The new apartment had three large rooms and a pretty nice backyard. And after a year, the owner, an older woman who lived on the first floor, began to have health problems. When she decided to sell the house, Paul and Ellen were given first dibs on it, and it was in really good condition, and it met the Veterans Administration requirements for a mortgage. The neighborhood was working class and respectable. So the first thing the Bohms did was move to the first floor so they could rent out the upstairs for income. After Ellen's mother lost her job and Paul and Ellen began helping her out with her bills, Paul decided, without consulting Ellen, to move Ellen's mother in with them. And he fixed up the basement and had Catherine move in downstairs. So while Ellen's mother, Catherine, had to share the bathroom with her daughter and son-in-law and then the grandchildren, she did have some privacy and independence. She had a microwave and a refrigerator, and she had her own entrance. And it was affordable. She didn't have to pay rent or utilities or even a phone bill because Paul hooked up a line from their phone. But Ellen never wanted her mother to move in with them, so she didn't like this. She didn't like her mother.
No, that's plenty obvious.
Yes.
Throughout.
And I don't know how bad her mother was, but her mother certainly did help her out a lot.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, she was the ready-made babysitter.
She was. I mean, she didn't really have any money to help her out with, but she was there for the kids.
Yes, she was.
But, you know, to Ellen, this was supposed to be her new beginning. She was young, and she certainly didn't want to live with her mother. She'd just gotten away from her mother. She wanted to have her home with Paul, and she wanted to start her own family. So she'd have the home, the family, and the man. But her mother was just like an intruder, as far as Ellen was concerned. She didn't seem to appreciate that the mother would take care of the kids.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Because right in the first year of their marriage, they had a daughter named Tracy. Tracy's not her real name, but that's what I'm going to call her for privacy's sake. 2 years after that, Ellen became pregnant with their second child, and that was Stephen. Stephen was born in 1985, and their youngest child was another son, David, born pretty much right after Stephen in 1986. But by the time she was pregnant with David, trouble in the marriage was really becoming something you couldn't avoid. It was intruding on day-to-day living. Besides Paul's instability as a husband and a father, Ellen had developed this strange obsession with professional wrestling. And I don't mean like Olympic wrestling. I mean like WWF.
Right.
I don't know a lot of the lingo or anything, but, you know, the entertainment crazy stuff.
Right. Fake stuff.
Yeah.
Ellen's love for wrestling was so prominent in her life that she attended matches wherever she could. If there was a match in town, she never missed it. During the first year of their marriage, Paul went along with Ellen to the wrestling matches. He didn't share her degree of enthusiasm, but he did want to spend time with his new wife, and wrestling made her happy, so win-win, right? Paul and Ellen bought season tickets for the local matches, and she was thrilled to find that they had seats in the fourth row. So that's great, be right up front. These matches, as anyone who's ever seen professional wrestling, these are circus-like events made for casual entertainment. As far as Ellen was concerned, though, they were everything.
Everything. I mean it, really.
Everything. They were certainly a welcome distraction from her life as a mother and a secretary. Soon enough, though, Paul found it difficult to sit through these stupid matches, and he just couldn't understand how his wife had the passion she seemed to have for it.
And I don't know if it was actually the activity or if it was just the guys. She seemed to like the big, sweaty, muscly men, which I know a lot of women like that. I'm more into the skinny intellectual types. So then one night, though, they were in the packed Kiel Auditorium, and there was another couple sitting right in front of Paul and Ellen. They had season tickets, too, and just like Paul and Ellen, it was the wife who was the real wrestling fan. And they were about the same age. Deanne Smith had been married in the fall of 1980, and like Ellen, Deanne had insisted on getting season tickets, but her husband wasn't thrilled. So eventually she picked up on Ellen's enthusiasm about the matches, and soon Deanne was turning around to talk to Ellen. Ellen and Deanne seemed like two peas in a pod. Deanne had been working as a legal secretary downtown, and besides being a young wife who loved professional wrestlers, Deanne also had a pretty serious weight problem. Ellen found it really hard to lose the weight she put on with each pregnancy, and by the time she was pregnant with her second child, Stephen, which was when she first met Deanne, she was definitely morbidly obese. So she was really not very healthy at that point, and probably not feeling great about herself.
Probably not.
And I don't think Paul was probably a big help to her self-esteem either.
Paul probably didn't even notice.
Yeah, right.
So the two women became really good friends. They had a lot to talk about. Wrestling, they talked about dieting, they talked about their husbands. One reason why their marriages were both failing was their shared obsession with the wrestlers. Ellen soon noticed that Deanne's husband had stopped coming to the matches. Then Deanne noticed the same thing about Paul. When Deanne told Ellen that she was getting divorced and using her maiden name, Bond, Ellen was very sympathetic. Deanne gave Ellen her phone number, and they became phone friends each night after work. So the calls gradually became pretty regular, but Deanne didn't mind. She really enjoyed talking with Ellen. And she also learned how lonely Ellen was. Paul didn't come to the matches anymore, and as Ellen confided to her, he also wasn't coming right home after work.
No. So by the following year, their daughter Tracy was almost 5 years old, and Ellen was pregnant, and Paul was spending progressively less and less time at home after work. On September 22, 1985, their son Stephen was born. Then Ellen was almost immediately pregnant again. She and Paul decided that after their third child, Ellen would go back to work. But the marriage was not strong enough to survive these changes. She'd already gone back to work, then she'd stayed home. Now she was going to have to go back again. Paul spent more time in the neighborhood bars than he did at home, and she was really developing a true obsession with the managers, the performers, pretty much all these guys that were in the professional wrestling circuit. So as things got worse at home, she just started getting more and more into that.
Yeah, they followed their favorites as far as they could manage. And most of the time doing that required just a drive in the car, and they'd take turns driving. Now, over a Memorial Day weekend in 1986, Deanne and Ellen went on a lengthy road trip. They started in the morning in St. Louis, then headed southwest across the state for a show that night. Then the next morning they were back in the car heading southeast through Arkansas into Louisiana. Doing that would let them catch up with the same performance that would be held again that night. Then the next day they drove to Little Rock to see a third, again, virtually identical show. So at this point they're hundreds of miles from home and they're looking at a 7-hour trip. But Ellen was really stoked about this trip. And also by this time, the wrestlers and the managers and the referees recognized them. So Deanne and Ellen, they were definitely regulars. And of the performers who knew them, Ellen was especially crazy about Ted DiBiase, better known on the circuit as the Million Dollar Man. Ellen had watched and followed him for several years, 6-7 years, and she began to write to him on a regular basis.
Yeah, so I would call them groupies, but they weren't hooking up. I think that at least Ellen wanted to be a groupie, because they were following these guys around, and she started writing really suggestive, romantic-type letters to some of these guys. So her big payoff came when the managers and the wrestlers would come down the aisle and recognize Deanne and Ellen. That made both of them feel like they were more than just fans, they were part of the show. A referee, a manager, and DiBiase, the Million Dollar Man, I'll let Ellen and Deanne know that they appreciated it when they went on the road and followed them. Ellen made a trip to Kansas City, which was a 500-mile drive, just to be there when the ticket office opened so she could buy seats in the first few rows. Ellen's behavior could be seen as strange, especially considering she was married with two little kids and she had another child due in a couple of months. Paul, in the meantime, was becoming interested in a new woman. No surprise there. And this woman's name was Terry. Just like Ellen had been when he met her, Terry was a young woman who rode on his bus. So Terry wrote her name and address on a piece of paper for him when he asked, and for weeks she rode the bus every day to and from her college courses, and they would flirt. So it was barely a week after Ellen returned from her Memorial Day weekend trip when Paul gave her the bad news. This was June 6th of 1986. the day they were supposed to celebrate their 6th wedding anniversary. Paul told Ellen that he didn't want to leave her, but that he had to go get treatment at a Veterans Administration hospital in Texas. Ellen knew that Paul did think he suffered from some illness that was caused by his exposure to Agent Orange during his time in Vietnam, so that kind of made sense. He did break out in rashes all over his body sometimes for no known reason, but he told Ellen that he would be spending a couple of weeks at a VA hospital in town, and then they would move him to Texas. He further explained that the treatment he was getting would take months. He would have to quit his job, he said, but if he never got the treatment, he'd never be well. So she believed him, even though it was a really strange story.
I think that's lightly stated.
Well, and the thing
is, it's a really strange story.
Why would he lie like that to her? That's just the lowest of the low. It's bad enough he's leaving them, but he won't even tell her the truth. He's just going to disappear, basically, is what he wants to do.
That's what he's planning.
Yeah. So pretty low.
You know, she might have had legitimate reasons to doubt his story.
Absolutely.
Because he'd been gone a lot at night, but she always blamed his drinking for the behaviors. When Ellen told Deanne about Paul's upcoming hospitalization, Deanne was suspicious.
Yeah, Deanne seemed to have more common sense.
Just a bit. And Deanne thought that the doctors should have met with and spoken to Ellen, as well as Paul. She recounted to Ellen when her husband had a scheduled surgery how the doctors had met with them both to go over everything. So Deanne suggested that Ellen drive by the local hospital to see if his car was there. So after he'd been gone for a week, Ellen drove down to the VA Medical Center in South St. Louis. Guess what? No car. So then Ellen got a phone call from a former co-worker, and this person told her that Paul was having an affair with the co-worker's wife. And Ellen soon learned that Paul had left town with this other woman. And this is the young passenger from the bus route.
But on July 25th of 86, the day their little son David was born, Paul showed up at the hospital, and he acted like a proud dad. He even held David and posed for a photo in the maternity ward. But that would be it. Little David Brian Boehm was a happy baby with bright eyes and an easy smile. His father only saw him that once, and in less than 2 weeks, Paul was driving with Terry to Dodge City, Kansas, not Texas. So Terry was his third wife. Ellen had to return to her house as a single mom. So just as her father had abandoned his first wife and children, and then his second wife and Ellen, Paul had abandoned her and her 3 young children. It almost seemed predictable in a horrible way.
Almost did.
Yeah. But just like that, Ellen was alone, and she was responsible for supporting 3 children on not a very great salary. It was less than half of what they'd been making. So now she was dependent on her mother, who she basically despised, to babysit her children while Ellen went to work. So it seemed like just a simple bus ride and a charming driver had turned her life into this horrible burden. Ellen had gone from a carefree high school girl to a single parent with 3 demanding children. It was a story that Paul's first wife, Susan, completely understood.
Well, sure. It's deja vu.
Yes.
So Susan and Ellen kind of bonded over this. Susan's youngest daughter, Terry, was only 4 years older than Tracy, so the 2 girls liked to play together. And it seemed like a good thing for the 2 stepsisters to get to know each other. So they weren't best friends, Ellen and Susan, but they did like each other enough to go out and drink and dance together a few times. Susan liked wrestling okay, so she would sometimes go along with Ellen to the matches. But most of the time, the visits happened around Susan's kitchen table, and they were each talking about how they had fallen for such an irresponsible man while their daughters were playing in the background.
So as you can imagine, by the fall of 1988, Ellen was in financial trouble. She'd filed for bankruptcy, her house was gone, but she had found a better-paying job and an affordable apartment at least. Still, to make these ends meet, she did have to take a part-time job in the evenings delivering pizza. She worked 4 nights a week, earning $4.25 an hour, which was minimum wage at the time, plus 50 cents for each delivery, and whatever tips she could get. So Ellen was able to earn about another additional $85 a week from this part-time job. but that meant she was working over 60 hours a week. And she also was doing pretty much everything for the three children. Her mother did watch them quite a bit, but her mother wasn't going to do all the tasks and chores and everything that's required as a parent. Her mother was really not that well. So there was a lot on her plate. She had to get her children dressed and fed each morning, and then arrange for her mother to babysit. Then she went to work all day. Four evenings after working all day, she did the pizza delivery. Of course, she also had to fit in all the chores and shopping for food and taking the kids to appointments and trying to maintain a decent apartment. She was a single parent working just to maintain the basics. So for Ellen, the only real pleasure that she had was her addiction to professional wrestling matches, which she somehow always managed to afford. But it's just such a shame to me that she couldn't have enjoyed her children more and seen them as something that could be a joy in her life.
Well, that's what wrestling was.
Yeah, it's a shame, though.
Well, yeah.
Definitely.
From our viewpoint.
Yeah.
So by the time little David was a one-year-old, Ellen had attended numerous matches in town and also around the state. And she had also made six overnight road trips with Deanne to watch wrestling. So Catherine, Ellen's mom, always watched the kids for her when she went to the matches.
Well, and she was really lucky that way. It's really hard when you don't have daycare, and she wouldn't have been able to work the evening job. She would have had to pay for a sitter, or she would have had to have latchkey children.
Right.
Although the boys weren't old enough to do that. But it was a burden, and I can understand that. But the way she went with it is just tragic.
In August 1987, Deanne and Ellen went to Kansas City, and that's where Ellen explored her romantic interest in Carl Fergie, who was one of the referees.
I like how you say explored her romantic interest. That makes it sound almost clinical, like she was thinking it through carefully, which is couldn't be farther from the truth.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, the attraction was definitely one-sided.
Yeah, she had absolutely zero chance of winning over Fergie, but she did have that strong fantasy life. Deanne, for her part, didn't try to stop Ellen because she thought that her friend needed a distraction. You know, they both love wrestling. They're out of town, hanging at the bar at the Howard Johnson Motel in downtown Kansas City.
Well, what could be better than hanging out at the bar at a Howard Johnson in Kansas City? I can't think of many things. But I think that was a real pleasure for her. It was an escape.
Oh, no question.
And she could really be herself with her friend Deanne.
Yeah, they had a lot of things to bond over, a lot of similarities in their lives.
Yeah.
Deanne could talk about her ex-husband. She could talk about how tough it was to make ends meet on one salary. And Ellen knew exactly what she's talking about. Ellen was supposed to be getting child support from Paul, but she never got any.
No, not any, ever.
Deanne recognized that Ellen had trouble distinguishing her fantasy life from the reality of the negative responses to her romantic overtures.
So the guys weren't really picking up on what she was putting down.
Apparently not.
But she didn't seem to get it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, Deanne could see that distinguishing fantasy from reality wasn't working.
Right, right.
Now, Ellen always photocopied her fan letters so Deanne could read them.
So she knew how they were.
Yeah. She didn't have to impress Deanne. She could be Deanne's friend. And Deanne never tried to interfere with Ellen's, I guess you'd call it an addiction.
Well, I think when you're an addict, someone who's going to interfere with what you're addicted to is not going to be with you very long.
Nope. But to Deanne, I mean, wrestling was a distraction or escape. Deanne knew that she was just enjoying a show, but she could see at the same time that Ellen was having a hard time walking away from it all the way she used to be able to do. She and Ellen were just two wrestling fans. They both loved to travel together. For the longer driving trips, they would stock up a cooler with sodas and sandwiches. And if they're going to be away overnight, they'd spend $30 or $40 at the grocery store for that. So the trips weren't cheap. They did try to be frugal, but it would cost $200, $300 if they were gone for 2 or 3 days. And whenever they stayed where the wrestlers stayed, it would cost even more.
Well, sure, but Ellen loved to stay in the same hotel because she'd want to try and meet these guys at the hotel bar.
Yep, and just sitting there having a cold brew and the million-dollar man sits down next to her.
So, although I understand the difficulties of a single mother and needing to escape, her priorities were messed up, and she was spending money she didn't have. So she was going on these trips and her utilities weren't being paid. First, you have to cover the basics. And she wasn't doing that. Deanne ended up moving out of the city of St. Louis, and she found an apartment across the river in Collinsville, Illinois. So remember how phone charges worked back in the 80s, those of you that were alive then. If you were out of town, it cost quite a bit to call somebody.
It was long distance.
Yeah. So they didn't talk as much on the phone. They would kind of talk to each other more from their work phones. So still, over time, they kind of grew apart because it wasn't so easy. Considering her finances, Ellen's addiction to wrestling was quite extravagant. She usually stayed at these cheaper motels, but she was also still splurging on some of the places where the wrestlers were staying. Her bankruptcy settlement, which was granted in September of 1987, included arrangements for her to pay off her debts. So this was pretty serious. It garnished her paycheck every month to make these payments. But she was also behind on utility bills. So the phone company was taking over $50 a month against an outstanding bill, and they eventually disconnected her service. Fortunately, she did have the security of her job and her mother's willingness to care for the children, but Ellen was just not happy with her life, not at all. And she continued to pack on the pounds. At 5'3", she weighed over 250 pounds. Like many women who are children of alcoholics or who suffer abuse as children, she was really seriously indulging in her fantasy about romance with those big, strong wrestlers, and of course they weren't giving her a second glance. The hope that she had for her life with Paul was just gone. And like I said, she wasn't able to really find joy in raising her children, although she was really lucky to have healthy, bright children. So many people would give anything for that. And I say that not minimizing the difficulties of single motherhood. I'm sure it wasn't easy. It's just tragic that she couldn't have put more into the kids and just tried to do things in a better way, obviously.
Well, wrestling had a hold on her.
Yeah, there's something definitely wrong with her mentally, and we'll talk more about that for certain.
Okay, but this seems like a good spot for us to take a short break to talk about our sponsor.
Yeah, let's do that. You know, doing this podcast every week, I pretty much live and breathe true crime. Then, for some reason, I'll go watch those reality TV shows to unwind, but, you know, that's a bad idea. It really dumbs you down. So when I need to really lighten the mood and have a mental palate cleanser, if you will, I play Best Fiends. It's like a guilty pleasure without the guilt. Plus, it makes me smarter, or at least not stupider. Best Fiends is fun because it's a unique puzzle-solving game that you can play anywhere, anytime. And it's endless fun because there are literally thousands of levels and new stuff is added all the time.
Yeah, I enjoy Best Fiends too. I like to play while I'm waiting in line, which I do frequently, or anytime I need a fun escape. I love puzzles, and Best Fiends is a match 3 puzzle game you can download for free. It's a casual game that anyone can play. It's easy to follow. You can play for a couple minutes, a couple of hours, because the game will pause and hold your place automatically. What's better than that? Right now, I'm at level 128, so I think I'm a little bit ahead of you, Jilly.
I think you snuck up on me, but don't worry, I plan on catching up this weekend. Those Best Fiends characters, they're bugs, and their antagonists are slugs. And they're all really cute. They're not like real-life slugs, which can be a bit off-putting. Best Fiends is a 5-star rated game that's as challenging as you make it. I've said it before, but I really am obsessed. In a good way. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect the cute characters. With over 100 million downloads, it's become very popular, and it's a must-play.
Download Best Fiends free in the Apple App Store or in Google Play. That's friends without the R. Best Fiends.
So that Thanksgiving 1988, Ellen made the meal, and she had her mother over to eat with her and the children. After she dropped her mom off at her apartment, she took Tracy, Stephen, and David downtown to see the Christmas decorations. Like an old movie, the children were pressed up against the plate glass to see the department store window displays. Ellen had to carry David because he was so tired. She lifted him above the heads of the bigger children so he'd be able to get a good look. So David was just over 2 years old. When they went home, it was close to 9 p.m., and on the ride home, David fell asleep. But this was only a nap, and it gave him a new burst of energy when they got back. By the time Ellen and the children were back inside their apartment, David was wide awake and ready to go. Ellen turned on the TV and began to watch Knott's Landing after sending Tracy and Stephen off to bed. And they went. They were asleep within minutes, actually. But little David didn't want to go to bed. He wanted to stay up and watch some of the show with his mom. So Ellen was planning to do some ironing while watching TV, and she had David settle on the floor. He was lying on his right side watching the TV. The loneliness of Thanksgiving without her husband had made Ellen feel very sad and melancholy. And now David wouldn't go to bed, so she was, I'm sure, very frustrated. But there's a lot that was going on inside her mind which we will never understand. She took one of the pillows from the sofa, got down on her knees behind David, and quickly, kind of out of nowhere, put the pillow over his head and held it there until he stopped breathing. Ellen then called her good friend Sandy, while she looked at her 2-year-old's limp body on the floor. Now, Ellen had known Sandy since they were in high school, and she chatted with Sandy about how their Thanksgivings had gone. As she made this small talk, Ellen could see little David lying there motionless on the living room floor. She told Sandy that David had refused to go to bed and that he was lying there watching TV. She mentioned that David had a bit of a cold and that she had bought him some cough medicine at Walgreens earlier. After about 15 minutes, Ellen suddenly said that she needed to go because something was wrong with David. But, of course, she didn't tell Sandy that David was pale and his lips were turning blue. Sandy just thought it was one of the normal motherhood interruptions.
Yeah, I'm just overwhelmed with sadness at that picture.
Isn't it terrible?
She's talking on the phone to her friend with her little 2-year-old son dead on the floor.
It's horrible, I know. And that's why I'm saying I don't know what was going on in her mind. It's really hard. Even doing research from things experts have written, it's really hard to... This is so unusual, so weird.
It totally is.
And so brutal, really. It's just impossible to understand.
So Ellen called 911. Then she went into the bedroom and woke up Stephen and Tracy. She told the kids that their brother had stopped breathing and they were going to go to the hospital, so they needed to get dressed quickly. Then Ellen left the apartment, saying she was going to find help. So there's another just totally incongruous thing.
Yeah, there's a lot, lots of stuff. So the children got dressed, and they were looking for their mother just minutes later, and Knott's Landing was still playing really loud on the TV. The paramedics showed up at the apartment while Ellen was still out looking for help. They knocked on the apartment door several times and had to keep getting louder. Finally, the door was opened by a really timid little Tracy. She looked terrified. And she led the 2 paramedics to the living room, where David was still lying there, pale and limp. So he was in cardiac arrest. They began CPR as they prepared to transport this boy to the hospital. And one of the men asked Tracy where her mother was. And she told him that her mother was downstairs. 10 minutes had passed by the time they were taking David to the ambulance. Then Ellen showed up. And she said that David had been sick. That's all she said to the paramedics. And the really weird thing was she didn't seem at all upset. And it was so weird, it was jarring to these paramedics. They were used to hysterical parents getting in their way, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then she declined to ride in the ambulance with him. And she said she needed to find someone to watch her other children. After the ambulance left, she called back her friend Sandy to get her to watch Tracy and Stephen, and told her David was taken to Cardinal Glenn and Children's Hospital by ambulance because he'd stopped breathing. So Ellen went to Sandy's house, and Sandy got her mother to watch the children so she could accompany Ellen to the hospital. To Sandy, Ellen did seem upset, but in control. When they got to the ER, a team of nurses and doctors were already working on David. They were unable to resuscitate him, but he was kept alive on life support devices. He had a body temperature of 101 degrees, and he was packed in ice to try and bring the fever down. The ER doctor told Ellen that David would not be moved from the ER until the next morning. So after an hour or so of being there, Ellen decided she was just going to go home and get some sleep. A lot to unpack there. Yes.
Then the following morning, David was admitted to the pediatric ICU. Condition was unchanged. Ellen had returned to the hospital after 9 o'clock, after getting what she would describe as a good night's sleep. And then once David was settled into the ICU, Ellen phoned her friend Deanne at her job. Deanne showed way more emotion over David's condition than Ellen had. She left work early, rushed to be by Ellen's side. And when she got to the ICU, she saw that Ellen looked just totally wiped and exhausted. Deanne could see that David's outlook was very bad, so she assumed that Ellen had probably been awake at his bedside all night. She felt sorry for Ellen.
Well, who wouldn't?
Right.
Right?
Here's your kid who's on life support.
2-year-old.
So she went into David's room with Ellen. The little child was pale white, and he was hooked up to medical equipment with tubes and wires.
So Ellen and Deanne went to the cafeteria, where Ellen told Deanne what had happened. She told her the same story she had told the paramedics and Sandy. David had been watching TV, and he just suddenly stopped breathing. He was turning blue, so she called 911. When the two women returned to the ICU, Ellen told Deanne that she wanted to go into the lounge and take a nap. This is a woman who went home all night and slept, and her toddler is on life support, just to make sure we're all clear on what's happening here.
We understand that.
Okay. So Deanne was heartbroken for her friend. And she told Ellen, well, of course, honey, go ahead and rest. I'll go in and be with David while you get some rest. So Deanne was told by the nurse that it was a good thing to talk to David. He needed someone to be with him and talk to him and touch him. When Deanne was by his side, she talked to him and she rubbed his legs, which were really cold. She wanted to pick him up and hold him, but there were too many medical things in her way. So she was there from the late afternoon until after 11 p.m. when the doctor came in.
Hours.
Hours. Mind you, Ellen's still in the lounge napping.
Yeah.
Deanne was asked to step out for a while so they could run some tests, and this would take about an hour. So that didn't sound that ominous. But then, when she asked what these tests were, she was just horrified to learn that they were doing a brain scan to check if he had any brain activity. So that is ominous, my friend.
It's not good, that's for sure.
No.
So she goes to find Ellen, and she's still asleep in the lounge.
Yep.
Then at 12:30, a doctor and a nurse approach Deanne, and the doctor explained that there was very little brain activity. Deanne was stunned. She woke up Ellen in order to give her the news. The doctor said they were going to do another scan in about 12 hours. But at the same time, the doctor said that there was nothing else that they could do for David. He said for Ellen and Deanne to go home, come back in the morning.
So that's like every mother's worst nightmare, which Ellen took as like, oh shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Rats.
So Deanne drove Helen home, and as she drove, she said to Ellen that she must be exhausted from staying up all night. And she was really shocked when Ellen responded that she'd gone home to sleep the night before. She really was just gobsmacked. She didn't know how to respond to that. But in her mind, she thought, who in their right mind would leave their child in the hospital in such serious condition? And how the hell did she sleep so much when this is going on?
Yeah, I mean, the only way she could explain it, at least to her mind, was thinking that Ellen must be in shock. And that's why she's acting so weird.
Yeah, I guess. People act differently.
Yeah. When they got to Ellen's apartment, Ellen wanted to watch wrestling videos.
So can you believe it? Jesus H.
I know. So the two women fell asleep in the living room. Then in the morning, Ellen asked Deanne to call the hospital. The nurse said, you need to come back to the hospital. David had not shown any progress. So back in the ICU room, Ellen walked over to his bedside and lifted one of David's eyelids. They could see that his pupil was fully dilated and didn't react to light. I don't know about you. This is like doctors and nurses are going to do that. This isn't something that a mom is going to be doing.
No, she didn't touch his head or kiss his cheek or try and climb in the bed with him. Very clinical, very cold. But at this point, it was clear that David would never be coming home. Deanne had spent time with the little boy, and it really broke her heart. He'd just been a really energetic, mischievous child. So another brain scan was done, and that afternoon a conference was done with his caretakers, Ellen and Deanne. The doctor told them that they were just keeping David alive on machines and that he was brain dead. But Ellen had no tears in her eyes as she told them to turn off the machines. In fact, she would be described as sounding matter-of-fact. Everyone reacts differently, but her behavior was not like anything any of these medical professionals had ever seen before, and they'd seen a lot of things.
Yeah, so the doctor explained to Deanna and Ellen that it would take about an hour for David's heart to stop beating. Deanna was just totally devastated, and she began to cry. She said to Ellen, "This is the roughest thing we've ever been through. Let's not do this again." Ellen gave her a smile that made the hairs on the back of her neck stand right up straight, feeling like, what's this saying?
Someone's walked over your grave?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Deanna was never going to be able to forget that strange smile.
Well, I'm thinking maybe in the territory of smirks.
Yeah.
Yeah, which are really shitty. There's nothing good about a smirk.
Now, the doctors couldn't find anything wrong with David that might have caused his death, so they decided to call it a crib death. I guess technically it could be, but this kid was 2.5 years old.
Yeah, 28 months.
So, unlikely. I mean, it's not impossible. But you just don't think sudden infant death syndrome in a kid his age.
Well, anytime we've heard of it in a kid older than a year, it's been murder.
Well, yeah, there's other reasons for it.
Yeah,
yeah.
But he wasn't an infant, and he'd been this bright, active boy. So it was really difficult to accept that diagnosis or cause of death.
Oh, definitely.
A lot of people questioned that.
So Ellen excused herself to call her mother. She wanted to tell her what had happened to David.
Yes, so note that she hadn't called her mother earlier, keep her up to date or give her a chance
right.
to come to the hospital.
Nothing.
No. But Deanne heard her telling her mother to put Tracy on the phone, and Deanne could tell that Ellen was planning to tell 7-year-old Tracy about her little brother's death.
On the phone.
On the phone, yes. So she stopped Ellen mid-sentence, and she explained to Ellen that she needed to tell the children in person. Ellen kind of argued, but Deanne insisted, and Ellen finally relented, and she just told Tracy that she'd be home soon.
Yeah, so when the doctor came over to tell Ellen that David had gone, had died, she seemed to take it without any emotion at all. Now, meanwhile, her friend Deanne is sobbing uncontrollably, looking at his perfect little face and body in the hospital bed. Ellen asked Deanne if she wanted to hold him, because he was Deanne's godchild. She had loved him. So she nodded, held him, and she handed him to Ellen, who had been given a rocking chair for this purpose. Ellen talked to him, saying, "Mommy loves you," a few times. But to Deanne, she seemed to be just a robot, not acting anywhere like she thought she should be acting.
No, I mean, she just sounded like she was faking it, really.
She acted like she was performing. She was trying to do something that she thought she needed to do.
Yeah, and it's just Deanne had a bad feeling. Of course, her mind did not go to murder right away. But her stomach was just turning. There was anxiety, just that feeling of doom that you get when something's not right.
Yeah, something is terribly wrong here.
And before holding David, Ellen had asked the doctor if they wanted any of David's organs. She mentioned they might want his eyes for science. The doctor explained that they couldn't do that because he'd had a fever, but the question seemed so matter-of-fact, like she was going to hand over a pair of old shoes.
Yeah.
Even the doctor was really put off by her. She was hard to tolerate. She was just so inappropriate to the situation. So Deanne finally left and drove herself home, of course feeling stunned that little David was dead, and that Ellen had been so weird, so composed. David had been pronounced dead at 3:40 p.m. on November 26, 1988. The hospital had no reason to notify the police of his death, but they did notify the medical examiner.
Yes, so when the medical examiner did an autopsy on David that Monday, he took samples of blood, tissue, bile, and urine. That same evening, Ellen began to make funeral arrangements, but she's also planning to buy first aid tickets for an upcoming wrestling match. So she called Deanne and told her that she wanted to make sure they got good seats. And Ellen offered to buy the tickets on her way to the funeral home. God.
What the actual fuck here? Isn't that just...
Yeah, I'll just stop and pick up the tickets on my way to
funeral
arrangements.
I'll be going by anyway, sure.
So Deanne tried to talk Ellen out of this, but she didn't want to argue with her. Her son's just died.
Right, right.
So she told herself, well, this must be how Ellen has a way of coping.
Right.
But Deanne would eventually lose her patience, lose whatever trust she had with Ellen. She just couldn't comprehend how her friend could be thinking about wrestling when she's getting ready to bury her 2-year-old.
Well, and not only the lack of grieving over David, but just no concern for the older two children who had seen their little brother dead on the floor, who had lost him. They'd already lost their father. Their father had dumped them. And their mom's working all the time, so they're really being taken care of by an elderly woman who was described as kind of standoffish. So just her whole motherliness is messed up super bad. That wasn't very articulate, but you know what I mean. It was not good.
I know exactly what you mean. Here's another little tidbit for you. It wasn't until the day after David's funeral that his father Paul was notified of his death.
Yeah, and not by Ellen.
He was told by his new mother-in-law. So he called Ellen, and they talked on the phone for a couple hours. Ellen told him that David had died of SIDS. So she said that she couldn't afford to bury the boy. Paul told her to use his veterans benefit of a no-charge burial at Jefferson Barracks. But Ellen said, I don't want to bury him there.
Yeah, it almost seems like she was just trying to get some money, which that's totally legitimate. He should be giving her some money. But I don't see what other reason she had for bringing it up if she wasn't going to go along with what he wanted.
Right.
She just ignored him. She went ahead and had David buried at the Trinity Cemetery. And at his service, her friends and co-workers just cried. There was this tiny coffin. It was one of the saddest things ever. Deanne was so upset, she couldn't even attend. She called Ellen and said, I'm sorry, I just don't think I can be there for this. But most of the people in Ellen's life were supporting her as much as they could. Still, many of them were shocked by her demeanor at the funeral. She was very stoic, very cold. She did cry a little a couple of times, but still, this lack of emotion was difficult to understand and just kind of off-putting to other parents who were devastated by this.
And days after the service, the medical examiner ruled that the cause of David's death was sudden death of undetermined etiology following a viral syndrome, viral illness.
Now, viral syndrome, that just seems like a catch-all to we don't quite know what it is to me.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what it is. I mean, you can do pathology and see that there's certain types of white blood cells in organs, and you can maybe say that this is likely caused by a virus, but it doesn't give you any degree of certainty as to how it caused a death.
No, and I think the viral syndrome was only even considered something because Ellen had said David had a cold.
Right, and he was running a little bit of a fever when they were...
When he came in, he did have a fever. You're right. I forgot about that.
So, yeah, I mean, you can say, oh, he had viral syndrome.
Sure.
A cold, stomach bug, and there's lots of viral illnesses.
But most of them don't kill you.
No. So you're still left with the question as to what caused the death.
Yeah, it was a little odd, but not enough to make them think something illegal had happened, something horrible.
Right. Her co-workers took up a collection and raised over $1,000. They knew that Paul was not paying support and that Ellen had been working two jobs. And then just days after the funeral, Ellen collected on a $5,000 life insurance policy on David's life from a policy given to her by her employer. So she got the $5,000. However, she refused to pay the funeral home's bill of $2,348.
Yeah. So Deanne wasn't the only person disturbed by Ellen's behavior after David's death either. Ellen seemed to just go right back to life as usual after that. This woman who'd been doing Ellen's nails for over 3 years every 2 weeks was surprised when Ellen returned just 1 week after David's death for her regular manicure. Even more surprising was Ellen's apparent mood when she did. She'd always talked about wrestling while getting her nails done, and that didn't change. She talked in a very upbeat manner about the $1 million man and other men, and of course suggesting that these men were interested in her. It didn't seem at all realistic to her, but the manicurist listened politely. But Ellen was acting as if nothing had happened, and the only thing she ever said about David was, all I have to do is get rid of his toys. So it's like it's kind of a checklist for her. Out with the old. She's done.
Get the new stuff.
Something's really missing in her brain.
Now, Paul was living with his third wife, that's Terry, in Tucson. Even if he had known about his child's death, he couldn't afford to return for the funeral. Actually, when they had arrived in Tucson, they had to get assistance from social services to get an apartment. Paul did find a job, and that was good, because Terry was pregnant. Paul was also upset that Ellen buried David in Trinity Cemetery against his wishes, but he had no say in this decision, and he hadn't invested any money in it either.
Well, no, and he really didn't have any say in anything. I can definitely understand that. He hadn't been a father.
He was gone.
He left when she was pregnant with him, what, and just came and visited him when he was born?
He saw him, what, the one time?
The one time, yeah. Ellen had collected enough money from the life insurance and those collections that were taken up for her to afford to pay the funeral home and also to purchase a proper headstone, but for some reason she didn't do it. She took Stephen and Tracy to Disney World in Florida, spent quite a bit of money on that, and she also took a road trip with Deanne to watch a wrestling match. Deanne didn't know that Ellen had collected any life insurance money or that she'd refused to pay the funeral home. Ellen didn't tell her that, because that didn't look good, and Ellen knew it didn't look good.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though she did a ton of stupid things.
By early 1989, Ellen had spent almost all the insurance money. She and Deanne were still seeing each other, but a lot less than they had been. But they still would manage to get together for lunch every once in a while. So one day, they're eating lunch in the cafeteria-style restaurant, and Ellen pointed to a man who worked at her company. And she said to Deanne that this guy was interested in her, and he wanted her to go away for a weekend with him. Deanne didn't believe her.
Well, no.
But Ellen had said similar things before. And she knew that Ellen had lied, often telling people that she had relationships with co-workers or wrestlers or whatever.
She's just kind of one of those people. We all know someone like this who just lies and exaggerates a lot.
Yes.
To just make themselves in a better light, I guess. So that spring, Ellen showed an unusual interest in a criminal case that was on the news a lot. And this was the case of Paula Sims. This is a case we've covered.
We have. What was that called? No Boys Allowed or something?
No Girls Allowed. She killed her daughters.
Right.
Yes. So this Paula Sims had reported a kidnapping of her infant daughter by an armed man who was wearing black clothing and a ski mask. And Mrs. Sims told the police that this man had ambushed her as she was taking out the trash. She said he had forced her back into the house and knocked her unconscious. When she woke up, her six-month-old daughter Heather was missing. So this was a really big story, as you can imagine, and especially because this was the second time that Paula claimed that this had happened to her. In 1986, her 13-day-year-old daughter, Lorelai, was taken by a masked gunman. 1 week after Lorelai was taken, her body was found in the woods out behind the Sims house. So now that a second daughter was missing, Paula Sims was under suspicion. And then in May, baby Heather was found dead in a trash barrel. But the thing is that Ellen was kind of obsessed with the case and liked to talk about it.
Yeah, she couldn't resist mentioning the case.
No.
So and her co-workers eventually stopped seeing this as just casual chit-chat once they overheard Ellen on the company phone inquiring with several companies about getting additional life insurance on her two surviving children. Uh-huh. So you think she figured, oh, this, it worked the first time, I can do it again.
Absolutely, but this time she was going to get more money.
Well, yeah, because that didn't last long enough.
No, she'd gone through it.
She was also showing pretty much complete indifference toward Tracy and Stephen. They were just commodities that she could do what she needed to do with.
Yes, unfortunately. It's so damn sad.
Then they also saw that on a 3-day wrestling trip in June, Ellen didn't call and check on her kids every day like she used to. Deanne noticed that.
Well, and Deanne thought she just lost a child. You think she'd be checking on them constantly?
You think she wouldn't take the trip?
Well, that would be the thing, wouldn't it? She shouldn't have taken the trip. But yeah, as far as making calls, she did kind of have a valid excuse. Her home phone had been shut off for non-payment. And I don't know why that happened after she'd gotten $6,000 and hadn't really used it to pay any bills.
Well, she paid her bills.
Well, not her phone.
Her Ellen bills.
Right. So to check on her children, she had to call her office, and she had told her mother to call there and leave messages for her if anything was up. So she didn't speak to her children that whole weekend. But you think the trip money maybe could have gone to the phone bill? Maybe that's a radical idea. Oh, but maybe instead of wrestling, she could have paid the phone bill. Especially since she had a child that died, you think she'd want to have access to a phone, at least for emergencies. You know, just a thought.
Just a thought.
Yep.
August and September of 1989, Ellen was a busy person. She got quotes for $30,000 in insurance on Stephen and Tracy. This would set her back $34 a month. So she told the salesman she'd think about it and call him back. Then she talked to a coworker and asked this person for a referral to an insurance business. So she called and asked this agent for quotes on a $30,000 policy for each child. She ended up buying two $50,000 policies. Both were issued on August 22nd. Then a few days after that, she called another insurance company and bought an additional $30,000 each. And then with the $5,000 work policies, each child was now insured for $85,000. So she then bought additional insurance for each kid so that each child had insurance for an even $100,000. So do you think she's going to kill them both at the same time or one at a time?
I think the plan was one at a time, but she really wasn't subtle about this. I don't know how she thought no one would notice.
Well, I know
what she was doing. And each company was unaware of the other policies. But it was really odd that Ellen was paying for these large life insurance policies on healthy children when she couldn't even afford to pay her utilities or her phone bill. So in April of 1988, 6 months before David's death, Stephen had been hospitalized for hypoglycemia. And it happened after a weekend trip to Chicago to buy wrestling tickets, of course. And that weekend, Stephen had seemed unusually sleepy. So when they returned home, he was still lethargic, he had a mild seizure, and he was kept at the St. Louis Children's Hospital for a few days. Because of this, Ellen wasn't able to get an additional $20,000 in Gerber life insurance for Stephen. So she tried to get more.
Not satisfied with the $100,000.
No, so that was held for review. But by the time a policy could even be written on him, Stephen would already be dead.
Mm-hmm. So did they have an explanation for the hypoglycemia?
No.
Well, I can see maybe if he'd had some concurrent illness and his intake wasn't very good, his blood sugar could be low or get low.
Right.
Doesn't sound like he needed anything to keep it up, keep his blood sugar up.
Maybe she wasn't feeding him.
True.
On the trip, I don't know.
Yeah, but it's not like he had an underlying disease.
No, the doctors didn't think so when he visited them, and the insurance company was going to go ahead with the policy.
Yeah.
So it seems like he was generally a healthy boy. But on September 13th, 1989, Ellen was doing her normal evening tasks of cooking and cleaning and caring for the kids after a long day at the office. Her daughter Tracy was taking a bath and playing with her Barbie dolls after reading Stephen a story and tucking him into bed for the night. As Ellen put away groceries, she could hear Tracy talking to her dolls as she washed their hair. But Ellen walked down the hall to her bedroom and got her hair dryer. She picked it up, plugged it in just outside of the bathroom door, and looked in toward her daughter in the bathtub. Tracy was washing her face so her eyes were closed when she heard something fall into the tub. As far as she knew, she was alone in the bathroom, but she felt this sudden pain coursing through her body, and she tried to get out of the tub, but she couldn't. She screamed for her mother, but she'd woken up Stephen, and he ran in before Ellen did. The pain stopped when Ellen unplugged the dryer. We'll go back and forth on that. Did Ellen really do that? Or did Tracy turn it off? But Ellen calmly asked how the dryer had gotten into the tub, and neither Tracy nor Stephen had any idea. Tracy got out of the tub with a small amount of blood coming from her mouth, and Ellen told her to go get dressed because they were going to take her to the hospital ER. While the children were getting dressed, Ellen said she was going to get Todd Andrews. This is a medical student who lived down the hall. But Andrews didn't answer his door. The children were both upset, and they began screaming and crying because they were alone. And Ellen was busy preparing her story to tell the doctors. So Ellen would tell the ER staff that Stephen was going to bed, and Tracy was taking a bath, and she was putting groceries away. Tracy was playing with her Barbie dolls in the tub. Then Ellen heard a scream come from the bathroom. Ellen ran down the hall and saw the cord in the outlet, and Stephen was awake and crying. Tracy was screaming. Ellen said she unplugged the cord and got Tracy out of the tub, and according to Ellen, Stephen told her that he had gotten the hair dryer for the Barbie's hair, and he had accidentally dropped it into the tub.
Okay, that could work.
It could work if she can get both kids to go along with it.
Yeah, have to do that. A neighbor had heard the commotion in the Boehm apartment and had called the police. So when the police arrived, the neighbor was waiting near the front of the building, and Ellen was there with her two crying kids. The girl was insistently saying something, and her mother was just as insistently hushing her. So Ellen was telling Tracy that if the doctors asked her what had happened, she should say that Stephen had thrown the dryer into the tub. She told her daughter that Stephen had told her he did it to try to dry the Barbie doll's hair. Tracy, even though she's only, what, 7 or 8, she knew this was not true. She had tucked Stephen into bed, and she knew that he had been sound asleep. So the argument between Tracy and Ellen was loud enough to worry this neighbor, who had called the police. But unfortunately, the police officer didn't hear any of this exchange.
Yeah, so at the ER, Tracy had calmed down, and she did repeat the story that Ellen had told her. She had dilated pupils and some petechiae, tiny hemorrhages on her tongue, but other than that, she was unharmed. Ellen was told to take her home and just bring her back if there were any issues. So it seemed to go off without a hitch. Maybe not really how she wanted, but she'd gotten away with it.
Yep, so far anyway.
Yes.
So 9 days later, on Friday, September 22nd, 1989, it was Stephen's 4th birthday, and the family celebrated it. Then the next day he saw his pediatrician. He was brought up on his vaccinations. He was given his DTaP and his oral polio vaccine. The doctor had pronounced him in good health. Ellen was told to watch him for a mild fever because of the pertussis vaccine that he'd gotten. And Ellen claimed he had been doing some vomiting that evening, had been unable to keep down anything. On Sunday, he was much better, so she had given him a liquid diet. He didn't eat much, she would later say, and he slept most of that day. So then on Monday, Ellen decided to stay home with Stephen. So after Tracy got on her school bus, Ellen took Stephen to her mother's apartment. They visited for a short time, and Catherine thought it made sense to keep Stephen home, as he was getting over the side effect of his vaccine.
Yeah, so it didn't seem like a big deal to Catherine.
No.
So next, Ellen drove to a payphone and she called her office. This is at about 8:15 a.m. The phone was answered by a colleague, and Ellen told her, "The same thing that happened to David is happening to Stephen." Ellen said that she was taking Stephen to Cardinal Glennon Hospital. He had just stopped breathing as she was getting dressed for work, she said. So the woman asked Ellen to call later and give them an update. She was, of course, concerned and felt bad for Ellen. But while she's saying this, Stephen was awake and active, fidgeting in the car. After Ellen hung up the phone, she headed back to her apartment. And on the way, she stopped at the grocery store and got some things. Then she stopped at the drugstore, where she bought some children's Tylenol. Then Stephen asked for Taco Bell, so she drove him there and bought him a bean burrito with cheese. On their way home, they passed the funeral home, where David's funeral had been. Stephen told his mother, "I want to see David." Ellen didn't answer, but then Stephen started to cry. He told her that he missed David. So she drove to the cemetery, and they visited David's grave. So some hours passed. It was about 11:30 a.m. when Ellen called her office back, and the same colleague answered the phone. Everyone had been waiting there for news on Stephen. This time, Ellen said that they were heading back to the hospital, that they couldn't find anything wrong with him the first time and let him go, but that on their way home, he had stopped breathing again, she said. But Ellen actually went home. She wasn't going to the hospital.
Right.
She told Stephen he could watch TV while she did some housework. So once home, she cleaned the kids' rooms. Stephen was on the living room sofa watching Sesame Street, and she could hear him giggling as she washed the dishes. Then when he was quiet for a few minutes, she looked in on him and he was dozing off a bit. That's when she took a sofa pillow and she smothered him, just as she had with David.
Just a completely matter-of-fact gesture.
Yes, and very planned. It's almost like she knew it was his last morning, so she took him to the grave and she bought him the burrito. It's so creepy. Then she just watched him on the sofa as he turned blue. She let time pass, sure.
So she ran out of the apartment. She went past the medical student neighbor's door, took the elevator up to the 8th floor. For some reason, she banged on the door of apartment 808, where an 82-year-old retiree lived. And she had meant to go to the apartment of a woman named Pauline, but Pauline actually lived on a sixth floor. No one answered the door of apartment 808 because that person was away on a trip. And we don't know if Ellen tried other apartments, but she eventually ended up knocking on the medical student's door, which is just down the hall from her apartment.
Which you think would be the first place she'd go, because she didn't have a phone.
He's a medical student.
Right.
He should have some knowledge, right?
At least CPR, right?
So it's just around 1 o'clock in the afternoon when Todd heard her knocking. That's the medical student. He called 911 and then ran to Ellen's apartment. And there's Stephen lying on his back on the sofa. Todd began to give him CPR. Ellen told him that he had been watching TV when he stopped breathing. And as they're doing the CPR, he's not responding. He's not coming around.
Well, they're not doing it. Todd's doing it. Ellen was not helping.
Yes. Paramedics arrived at just before 1 o'clock.
Yeah, 12:59.
12:59. Ellen told them that she would not be riding in the ambulance to the hospital. She would drive herself.
See, now this time that's even weirder. Last time, at least she had to find someone to watch her kids. This time, there's no reason for her not to be right with him.
None whatsoever.
But she's already got her plans of what she's going to do.
Yeah, apparently.
So the ambulance arrived at the hospital at 1:24 p.m. What Ellen did was she drove to her mother's place to pick up her mother. But her mother wasn't dressed yet, so she ended up giving her mother a $5 bill for a taxi, and she drove on to the hospital by herself. She arrived at the hospital a few minutes after 2 p.m., so like a half hour, over a half hour, after the ambulance had arrived.
Yep.
She called her office again and told them that the doctors were talking about taking Stephen off of life support. Ellen then called two of her women friends. She called Deanne at work, but Deanne was homesick with the flu, so she left a message to be passed on to Deanne. She wanted them to tell Deanne the same thing that happened to David happened to Stephen. So when asked when this happened, Ellen told the woman that it was sometime in the middle of the night. So all of these time frames are different to the different people she talks to. It's really a mess.
This isn't going to work for Ellen, is it?
No. When her co-workers came to the hospital after 4 that day, they noticed that Ellen wasn't even wearing her work clothes. Now remember, she had said that Stephen stopped breathing that morning as she was getting ready for work. That was her story to them.
That's right.
So why wasn't she in her work clothes then? So that was one thing that was just a little off, but not the only thing, I'm sure. The thing was, though, that Stephen was already off of life support. He was already dead. But Ellen didn't say that to her co-workers. He had actually been pronounced dead at 3:45. Ellen filled out some forms for organ donation, and when her mom showed up, her version of events didn't match what Ellen had told her co-workers. Catherine told the co-workers that Ellen had taken Stephen to see his brother's grave that morning. So her co-workers were like, huh? What is going on here? That doesn't make any sense.
It certainly doesn't.
And then another weird thing, Paul's first wife, Susan, just happened to be in the ER that afternoon. She brought her daughter in for a fever. And when Ellen saw her, she immediately said to her, the same thing that happened to David happened to Stephen. He died about 4 hours ago, and we donated his eyes. Who talks like that?
I know.
The matter-of-fact tone just must have been shocking. So as they walked out of the hospital together, Susan would say that Ellen pointed at two handsome young men in the hallway and said, I don't know what to do. They both want to go out with me. They work at my office with me.
Jesus.
Yeah, I just don't even know what to say.
So Ellen called Deanne that night and told Deanne the story of what had happened. When she said that Stephen had died in the afternoon, Deanne interrupted her because she had been told that he died in the middle of the night. The receptionist at Deanne's office had told her that it had happened in the middle of the night. So she's pretty stunned by all this. And she's certainly wondering, well, what the chances are of this happening to two children in the same family in less than 1 year's time?
I know. It was just frightening, yeah.
Frightening. But she couldn't make those thoughts go away.
Well, of course not. It's the second one.
Yeah.
And Ellen is acting really bizarre.
So Deanne's mind didn't immediately turn to Ellen murdering her children.
No, at this point, I think she cared about Ellen.
Yeah. Oh, they'd been friends for years.
Yeah. But the facts didn't add up, and she just couldn't ignore the inconsistencies.
Yeah. So Deanne had a friend in the police department, and she felt comfortable talking to this person. So Deanne called Sergeant Daniel Duffy and told him that she was concerned. Duffy took the names and addresses and all the information that Deanne had about the boys' deaths. Then he spoke to someone in a homicide. He learned that the medical examiner had started doing Stephen's autopsy, but had not yet determined what caused the child's death. Now, this was the same ME who had done David's autopsy less than a year ago. David's case, there was nothing suspicious other than the lack of a medical explanation. Well, okay, I would say that's suspicious of itself.
Right, but, yes, but that was one child, and yeah. Now you've got two. That really makes things much more suspicious.
He would rule out any errors in metabolism or poisoning. He would be able to rule out illnesses. He'd be able to rule out an accidental death. So the only possibilities for homicide were drugs, drowning, or asphyxia. Now, the top of the list would be asphyxia, because it would be tough enough to strangle a child without leaving marks. But someone could easily lay on top of the child or put something over his face without leaving any marks. This is called mechanical asphyxia, which is exactly what Ellen did. She smothered both her kids with pillows.
Yep, she did. Interviews with Ellen and then with the medical examiner led detectives to believe that Ellen had murdered her sons. When Paul learned of Stephen's death, he thought she was responsible. He said, "What the hell's she doing to my kids?" He contacted the local police where he lived and Child Protective Services, but that didn't really do any good because he didn't contact the authorities in St. Louis, and he didn't even confront Ellen. And he should have been concerned about the one remaining child, Tracy. The police certainly were. So they interviewed people in Ellen's life, including Deanne, and they eventually learned that Ellen had recently purchased more life insurance on her children. Actually, less than 30 days after Stephen's death, Ellen had gone to a car dealership and bought a new car outright. She didn't bother trading in her old car or even getting a loan. She just bought it with the insurance money. And this in spite of the fact she still hadn't purchased headstones for her two sons. So the medical examiner sent his autopsy findings and the medical records of the boys to 7 well-respected medical experts for their opinions. All of them ruled out every cause of death, with the exception of mechanical asphyxiation. All of the toxicology tests were negative, and Ellen and Tracy were tested for genetic cardiac issues, but their results were all coming back normal. EKGs performed on David and then on Stephen when they were admitted to the hospital on the days when they died showed no abnormalities. There was no evidence of prolonged QT syndrome, and testing on Ellen and Tracy showed no evidence of the abnormality either. Now, I see nowadays you can do genetic testing for QT syndrome.
For prolonged QT, you can.
Yeah.
But that's still a lot of cases that are not genetically tied.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, there are genetic studies that you can do to establish the diagnosis, but can have it with no family history whatsoever. Long QT syndrome, if you look at an EKG and all those squiggles, those are points, QRS and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So the QT interval is the distance between the Q pole and the T pole. So if it's longer, that means that the heart can have trouble repolarizing itself after it's had a heartbeat, and it makes you prone to basically sudden death.
So this is an issue with electrical activity.
Yeah, what'll happen is you get into an arrhythmia, and it oftentimes can be a ventricular arrhythmia or a ventricular tachycardia, rapid heartbeat, but it's a heartbeat that doesn't pump blood. So you have a non-functioning heart that's not doing its job.
Well, and the reason they would think about this is because it can cause sudden death in young people.
It can.
And if you've got two people in the same family who are young and apparently healthy,
maybe.
It is a lot of times a genetic thing.
Sure. But people can have it for years and not have any symptoms.
Sure.
You always tell people, if you've made the diagnosis, you should avoid doing things that could cause an increased heart rate, because that's when you're likely to get into trouble. And the basic treatment for this, for prolonged QT, is a beta-blocking agent that slows the heart rate down.
Well, not doing anything that raises your heart rate would really limit you.
Yes, it would.
But didn't look like these boys had any of this stuff.
No.
It's the bottom line.
Didn't.
So after Stephen's death, someone called the child abuse hotline and had concerns about Tracy, the only child left. The caller knew about Stephen and David's deaths, as well as the hairdryer incident. Now, Deanne hadn't known about the hairdryer incident, and neither did any of Ellen's co-workers. But they had gotten this anonymous call, and an intake worker went out to the school and interviewed Tracy. Tracy was in the second grade. She was a really bright girl who was able to remember the details of the recent events, although not always in chronological order. Like, she said that she knew Stephen had gotten sick and then he had some shots. So she had that kind of flipped around.
Right.
When asked about the hairdryer incident, she first said, "Stephen threw the hairdryer in the bathtub while I was bathing. My mother ran into the room and unplugged it. Then we went to the hospital." So that seemed to satisfy this worker. But in further interviews, they would finally get more of the details out of Tracy. Ellen was actually interviewed by that same worker, and she told the same story, of course. She's the one that came up with it. When asked about her boy's deaths, she also told this woman the same story she had told at the hospital, which, of course, was different from the story she'd told at Deanne's workplace and at her workplace.
Uh-huh. So in the apartment building where they lived and at Ellen's office, people were kind of shunning Ellen. They had taken up collections, as they had done after David's death, but they were withholding the money for Tracy. They weren't going to turn it over to Ellen. They had noticed that Ellen had complained about money problems, but she had also taken trips, bought a new car, refused to pay the funeral home, refused to buy headstones for the boys. She was working hard to make herself unliked.
Well, I don't think she had to work at it.
Ellen had Stephen's funeral arrangements done by a less expensive funeral home, but this funeral home made her sign a form giving them the money from a life insurance policy to assure that they would be paid.
Yeah, they called the previous funeral home and found out she hadn't paid, and she claimed that she wasn't satisfied with their services. But the thing is, when she found this other funeral home and heard that it was almost half as expensive, she was excited, like she found a real bargain on shampoo at Walmart.
Yeah, I made a deal.
Yeah. So despite all this, though, the police didn't have enough to charge Ellen with murder. Detectives continued to work the case. They interviewed Ellen's med student neighbor, who had tried to save Stephen by doing CPR. They also interviewed the manager of Ellen's apartment building, and that's how they found out about the hairdryer incident. They couldn't find records of Tracy being treated for the electric shock, but they were able to interview medical personnel who'd been there at the time. And the doctor remembered that on that night, both Ellen and Tracy were in the room when the doctors asked the questions about what had happened. So Tracy was with her mom. The doctor said that Tracy had not come right out to say it, but the suggestion was that her brother Stephen had dropped the hairdryer in the bathtub, and Ellen had told the doctors that because she wasn't in the bathroom, she hadn't actually seen what had happened. She just heard a scream and ran to see what it was, and she saw Stephen in the bathroom with Tracy. She said that then she'd assumed that he had put the hairdryer in the water. Tracy had told the doctor that she didn't remember whether Stephen was in the bathroom or not. Now, the other thing the doctor noticed was that Ellen seemed appropriately concerned about Tracy, so she didn't seem all cold and weird for this.
Right.
Of course, this was a much more minor situation.
Now, the neighbor who had called 911 on the night of the hairdryer incident called the police, told them that he was walking in the hallway on the night Tracy was hurt, and he heard a loud screaming coming from inside the Boehm apartment. So he was in the lobby waiting for the police to arrive. And while he was there, Ellen and the kids came downstairs, and he overheard Tracy saying he was not in the bathroom. There was nobody there. And she kept saying that over and over.
Yeah, and remember, that was like an argument between mother and daughter.
Yeah, they went at it a little bit. So detectives had Ellen come in for an interview. She brought Tracy with her. So there, a female detective took Tracy into a separate room to ask her about the hairdryer incident. Now, when asked about what had happened the night that the hairdryer ended up in her bath, she said she had just read a story to Stephen. She tucked him in and he was asleep. She told her mom she was ready to take a bath and she ran the water for her. And Tracy had some of her dolls with her and she was washing her face with her eyes closed and she heard something fall into the water. She splashed some water on her face, looked down and saw the dryer. She started to scream and stand up, but something kept pulling her down. Now, it wasn't a person, but every time she tried to stand up, something kept pulling her down.
So I think that was the electricity, what it did to her muscles.
Possibly. Tracy described how she managed to pick up the hairdryer, shut it off, and throw it out of the tub. And then she was able to get out of the tub by herself. By this time, her mother had come in and asked what the problem was, and Tracy said she explained what had happened, and then her mother told her to get dressed because they would go to the hospital. Her mother told her she was going to get Todd, the med student next door neighbor, to take a look at her, but he wasn't at home. Tracy said that on the way to the hospital, her mother told her that if the doctors asked what had happened, just to say that Stephen had thrown the hairdryer into the tub. Her mother explained that she had talked to Stephen and that he had thought she would want to dry her doll's hair. Tracy also said that on the way to the hospital, her mother told her that she had pulled the plug out of the wall.
Right, so...
But we're starting to get some...
Starting to become clear here what's really going on.
Yes.
But the fact that she did this to Tracy just a very short time before she killed Stephen, it's like it didn't matter to her which one she was going to kill. It was just to get the money, and she really wasn't attached to either one.
That's correct.
Very odd, very horrible. So Ellen's interview was pretty vague, but she did agree to take a polygraph. And when it was done a few days later, the results came back inconclusive. After the polygraph, Ellen was questioned by detectives again. She was asked about the medical bills from David's death. The detectives had just learned that Ellen had claimed in bankruptcy court that she had $16,000 in bills to pay for medical treatment for her sons and for their funeral expenses. So she'd lied to the bankruptcy court because her health insurance had covered everything but $500. So then they asked her about an insurance policy, and Ellen told them that one company had refused to pay $10,000, claiming that the policy had lapsed. But Ellen was adamant that this policy had not lapsed, and she was still angry that that company hadn't paid her claim. So much more concerned about that than she ever seemed to show for her children.
You're right about that.
But, you know, the way she was a mother before and then after Paul left, it seems like when Paul left, something just kind of shut down in her.
Well, I think once he left and she found the new reality of being a single parent, and crushing debt, and not enough time in the day to do everything you needed to do, yeah, it'll wear on you.
Yes, but it usually doesn't tear your affection away from your children.
It shouldn't result in murder, that's true.
No, but it just seems like that ended, that dream was over, those children were part of that dream, so she was done with them emotionally. So the medical examiner had finally excluded every possibility for cause of death except for mechanical asphyxiation, and this was by the fall of 1991. So on September 12th, indictments were issued charging Ellen with two counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of David and Stephen, and one count of first-degree assault for the hairdryer incident with Tracy. And the decision was made the best time to arrest Ellen would be on a Friday after work. And I forget why they said that, but that was what the FBI said.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's the weekend coming up.
I guess. Maybe you're more tired and more compliant.
You're not thinking of things much.
Maybe. But she was definitely surprised when she got pulled over in her nice shiny new car. They brought her in. They sat her down in a room set up with charts of her financials, insurance policies, and her children's medical records. And this was all like a ruse that the FBI had recommended they do. They had a room that had a sign on the door that said the Boehm case and had some numbers on it. And then if you went inside, they had set up old coffee cups and full ashtrays, and they had a few guys sitting there like this was a big operation.
So they're working 24 hours a day trying to solve this.
Yeah, and hanging up all her financial things, their medical records in big print on the wall. So it was really psychologically quite a tactic, and it did seem to work.
Well, it certainly did work.
Yeah.
Within an hour, she was confessing.
She was. But as was her way, she showed very little emotion even then. She said that she'd been overwhelmed by being a single mom with no child support from her ex, and she had given in to killing the boys, whatever that means. But she still wouldn't admit to the assault against Tracy. That was something she was not going to confess to. But the officers convinced Ellen to give a videotaped confession. Her descriptions of suffocating her children were very difficult to hear.
I can imagine.
Ellen was given a public defender, and she agreed to plead guilty if they took the death penalty off the table. So she's still only 32 years old when she was convicted. She was given 2 life terms in prison to run concurrently without the possibility of parole. So Ellen was incarcerated at the Women's Reception Diagnostic and Correctional Center in Vandalia, Missouri, where she was supposed to get good therapy and treatment. Let's hope she did. But poor Tracy, she was put into foster care. There's not much out there about her. I did read that she, as a teen, was hospitalized for depression, but we don't know where she is now. We don't know her real first name, which is good, but she'd be in her late 30s now.
That's right.
But she was left an orphan without her brothers. She lost everyone. So of course she was depressed. How do you function?
With difficulty.
Yes. So of course Ellen had some kind of psychological disorder.
Yes, she did. Maternal filicide, which is mothers killing their own kids, is rare. But each time it occurs, it raises the question, how could it have happened?
Yeah.
So rare as it is, there's something about the mother-child relationship that can go terribly wrong. Now, according to the Department of Justice, women commit only 14% of violent crimes in the U.S., but a study on filicide shows that women commit nearly half of all parental murders. A 2014 Brown University study that analyzed 32 years of filicide arrests found there are about 30,000 instances annually in the United States where a parent kills a child. My God, what a horrible statistic.
I know, right? It really is. But if you go online and look at the news, there are so many horrible stories. So many. And a lot of them do have to do with mental illness. But there are different kinds, or different motives, I guess. There are 3 main motives that are usually what's going on in these cases. So the first one is altruistic filicide. And that's the most common motive, and that's where a mother rationalizes that killing her child is in the child's best interest. So with that, Andrea Yates, she was mentally ill, but that was her motive. She thought the children needed to die to go to heaven or something. So I think that would include some real religious psychosis in that motive.
It could. She could also fit into a psychotic filicide, Andrea.
Well, yes. And I think that these overlap in a lot of cases.
Oh, sure.
But the altruistic also makes me think of the Hart family, the 2 women who drove over the cliff with their 6 children.
Yes.
So they must have been thinking that the children were better off dead. That's all I can think.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, it's all more complicated than that. But the psychotic filicide is when a mother kills without an understandable motive, maybe hearing voices. Doesn't seem to be any indication of that with Ellen.
No.
There's fatal maltreatment filicide, where a mother doesn't really mean to kill her child, but the death occurs after cumulative abuse. And we've done some cases like that as well. So Ellen is kind of rare among these women and their motives. Just cold-blooded money, right?
That's what it is.
It really is. But there was something missing that you could do that for money.
Yes.
Yes. Just crazy. So our sources for this case: The Washington Post, Why Do Moms Kill Their Children? That was written by Matthias Gaffney in June of 2014. A book, Sleep My Child Forever, written by John Costin. The Owlcation, February 2017, Mommy Needs Money, Why Ellen Boehm Murdered Her Children. That was written by Kim Bryan. There's an episode, which I wasn't able to find and watch, but I thought I'd just let you know in case you want to look for it. It's a Deadly Women episode, called Evil Guardians on Investigation Discovery. And her episode is Single Mother Ellen Boehm Killed 2 Sons for the Life Insurance. And that was from back in August of 2013. So TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. I hope you enjoyed that. If you have any comments, a case suggestion, or even a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tiegrabber.com. Or you can go to our website and leave a comment or a voicemail. I'll also put a link in our show notes so you can contact us or leave us a voicemail through that route. If you'd like to get your future TCB episodes without commercials and get an extra members-only episode each month, and when you sign up, that means you get all the members-only episodes going back years, so a lot more episodes to binge if you've run out, plus we'll send you a gift So you can check that out by going to tiegrabber.com. There's a subscribe button. You can see what your options are and see if that works for you. It's not for everybody, but a lot of people have signed up and seem happy with it. Also, if you enjoy the show, we'd very much appreciate your leaving a review for us on iTunes or wherever it is that you listen. We love to get new reviews. So anything to add today, Dickie? We're going to skip the feedback because we've been talking a long time.
Yeah, this ran a little over, didn't it?
Yeah, we'll do the feedback next week.
Let's do that.
Okay, well, thank you everyone for listening today.
We'll save a seat for you.
See you at the quiet end.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.